This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today is our wavelength producer, Ali Johan.
Hey, Lee Chui Lin.
Hello, Ali Johan. I'm better known as our local music man from the weekends. Ali is joining me today to discuss the history of music and drugs. I suppose it's no mystery to anybody that music and drugs have a long, long, long history, going from rock and roll to jazz to dance music of today.
That's right.
Do we, you know, is there a reason why we're talking about this in particular?
Well, I just thought it would be interesting for us to discuss this because it's kind of synonymous. People who do music, or rather people who think people who play music do drugs all the time.
There is that. And there's also, I think, the idea that people feel like they need to be doing drugs to enjoy music a little more. And while that may not be true, that's nevertheless still, you know, it's a very close association. Mm-hmm. So we're going to kick things off with what is probably one of the better known associations between music and drugs. Let's see if you can get who this is.
When it hits it, you feel okay. Whoa, I say one good thing about music. When it hits it, you feel okay. Hit me with music, yeah. Hit me with music now. This is French town rock. Don't watch that.
Of course, Bob Marley. That was Trench Town Rock.
And why do we play Bob Marley?
Well, reggae music has been really closely linked with the usage of marijuana. And what I found here is quite interesting. Apparently, the left hemisphere of the human brain will function with logic and analytics, and the right hemisphere is responsible for creative expressions. But the usage of marijuana doesn't necessarily make a person more creative, but rather it turns off the logic, and the person can't help but to rely on the right brain hemisphere, which is the creative side, right?
You know what's funny? I just read an article yesterday that basically argued that this isn't true. But they did say that an awful lot of actions and thoughts and thought processes are actually associated with the right side of the brain that you associate with creativity. So what you're saying is actually pretty accurate.
Yeah, and you know, like many other types of narcotics linked to music, the earliest recorded usage of marijuana was in jazz, actually, not in reggae. That dates back to 1909.
And according to cannabis historian, a type of historian that I didn't even know existed till today, Ernest Abel, he says, unlike booze, which dulled and incapacitated, marijuana enabled musicians whose job required them to play long into the night to forget their exhaustion. Moreover, the drugs seemed to make their music sound more imaginative and unique, at least to those who played and listened while under its sensorial influence. We do also have some thoughts on this by Dr. Mahmoud Mazlan, who is an addiction specialist.
Calming effect, mildly euphoric, it has the slight antidepressant property. When listening to the music, you will feel more pleasurable. Certain segment of the population, those who are vulnerable to psychosis, especially schizophrenia, you got family history of schizophrenia, marijuana will precipitate schizophrenia in this particular segment of the population.
And that was Dr. Mahmoud Mazlan, addiction specialist, talking about marijuana. Now, having said that, I mean, we're just talking about basically how it's linked. And you were mentioning jazz there.
Yeah, and 1931 was the first time the legendary singer Louis Armstrong, he was caught lighting up a joint during a performance. But the police and judge were big fans of him. So from a possible 6 months jail term, they just kept him in the LA jail for 9 days.
That sounds about right. And the Beatles got their first taste of cannabis through their good friend Bob Dylan. So it's not exactly something that's just confined to jazz or reggae.
That's right. Of course, reggae stylistically it originated from jazz as well as one of its...
How does that work?
Well, reggae came from a lot of different types of music, mento being one of them, the kind of traditional music in the Caribbean, and jazz was one of it, blues is one of it as well. So but more importantly, reggae musicians use cannabis in a religious and spiritual context, because they might have been, or they still are, Rastafaris. And in that sort of religious setting, they use it to accompany them in Bible study.
So there you go. I think it's interesting to note that, because the modern conception or the modern concept of drugs and music, I mean, this is probably one of those most deeply entrenched associations between reggae and marijuana. And it's kind of nice to know that, A, it's not just a drug used for recreation. It's also a drug used, in this case, spiritually.
Yep.
And also that it has its origins in jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to our next genre and drug, more or less, we're kicking things off with this song. She don't lie, she don't lie, she don't lie. Cocaine.
Yeah, J.J. Cale with the song Cocaine. Eric Clapton also has a song with the same title.
Actually, there are lots and lots and lots of songs either referencing cocaine or having cocaine in the title. There's Cocaine Blues. There's Moonlight Mile by the Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Brownstone by the Guns N' Roses.
Some would argue entire albums were built on this stuff. The drug was super popular in rock and roll.
Yeah, from the Rolling Stones to J.J. Cale that you heard earlier, Fleetwood Mac to Guns N' Roses.
And this drug apparently came to prominence in the 70s, but particularly in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been credited with a lot of creative output. And I don't know that that's necessarily... people have credited it, but people have also cautioned against its use. So it's one of those things.
Yeah, and fun fact here, 90% of North American paper money contains traces of cocaine.
And so it's apparently very, very widespread.
Yeah, but apparently musicians were on cocaine to make music more than to listen to it.
And for that, we have, again, Dr. Mahmoud Mazlan explaining why that might be.
Cocaine is an organic stimulant. You feel happy, you feel energetic, you're thinking fast, you're hypersexual, sexual drive is up, your sexual performance is up, and you will be very happy whatever you are doing. It enhance your performance. It's highly addictive. It's very expensive here. To consume that here in Malaysia, you need about a few hundred ringgit in a day. And then once your tolerance develop, you need a few thousand ringgit in a day. So it can cause paranoid. Once you stop it, it can cause very severe depression.
And cocaine was, of course, also very closely associated with the 80s, as we've mentioned. And mm-hmm. the 80s as a decade, while there were a lot of different genres kind of flourishing, it's also remembered quite often as the decade of a certain genre of hard rock. You know, what exactly are we discussing here?
Hard rock is like hair rock, you know, big hair, glam rock, spandex pants, bands like Motley Crue come to mind, or Guns N' Roses, Van Halen.
How does hard rock in this setting differ from, say, metal or, you know, from rock and roll as such? Because I think it owes debts in certain directions, but nonetheless, it's quite distinct.
Yeah, I think these guys were singing more about love than anything. And they're not really that brutal, but they looked the part, though.
But they didn't sound necessarily as hard, so to speak.
Yeah, it's weird that it's called hard rock, but it's in today's world, it's actually just modern rock. But you know, back then, I think it was new to them. It was just more ballads, and some people call it soft rock as well. So hard and soft in the same category almost.
And I guess it's stuff that we're familiar with, like from Guns N' Roses, for instance, would be a pretty good representation of the genre.
Sure.
Yep. Today I have Ali Johan from Wavelength here at BFM 89.9 discussing the relationship between music and drugs. Coming up, we continue this conversation on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Oh,
And that was The Beatles, Within You, Without You. Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today, Ali Johan from Wavelength here at BFM 89.9, a show that you can catch at 3 o'clock on Saturdays.
4 o'clock, actually.
4 o'clock, has it moved? yeah, so at 4 o'clock on Saturdays, Ali Johan on Wavelength. And he's here today to discuss the links between music and drugs. Again, it's not news to anybody that there is a long, long, long link between the two. So we're here today to try and elucidate them through the years, through the decades, through the genres. And so why were we listening to The Beatles?
The Beatles were heavily linked with psychedelia. And that meant that people knew that they were always on LSD, or the street name is called acid to some people. It was not clear whether the Beatles were on it throughout their entire career, but their later albums, before they dissolved, possibly from the mid-60s to the late-60s, you know, they put out albums like the Magical Mystery Tour and the White Album that had them experimenting with a lot of sounds. And I mean, people who follow the Beatles would know that they actually, the whole band went to India and...
And there are endless, endless discussions as well, of course, about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which is possibly one of the better known references. Although John Lennon argued that that had nothing to do with the fact that the song titles formed the initials LSD, that didn't stop people from imagining that it was so. And what? How closely linked do you think were the drugs to the music that it spawned off?
Quite close, because in that era, the mid-60s, there was sort of like a boom of psychedelic bands in general. They were not only the Beatles, the Zombies came out, and other bands, you know, their names escape me right now, but The Doors especially, another band that's heavily linked with LSD. Jim Morrison.
The Grateful Dead.
Mm-hmm.
But what exactly is psychedelia as such? I think, you know, in the modern day and age, we just think of it as lots and lots of colours, but nobody really has, you know, what does it mean to say one plays psychedelic music? What are the elements involved?
Okay, I think it comes from garage rock that came out in the late 50s to the early 60s. And psychedelic music has a lot of layers. So it also came about with the advancement of recording technology. So bands were able to record layers upon layers of vocals, for example. The Beach Boys were known to have like, what, 40 layers of vocal tracks alone in their album Pet Sounds. Brian Wilson is another guy who's not an advocate, but people knew the Beach Boys as also a very nice sunshiny pop band, but also had psychedelic pop influences.
And in keeping with that, on the 16th of October 1965, the first self-built psychedelic rock show took place at the Longshoremen's Hall in San Francisco. It was advertised as a tribute to Doctor Strange and attended by 1,000 devotees. The gig featured the Marbles and Jefferson Airplane, who invited their followers on stage to sip acid-spiked punch from a gigantic chalice, in case you were wondering what that kind of gig might look like. And again, we have Dr. Mahmoud Mazlan, who's explaining what LSD does within the brain and the body.
LSD is very uncommon here. It comes in a paper form. It makes you hallucinate. You see images. It's something like a dreamlike state. Unfortunately, it can cause severe aggression. Because of that, not many people will be dependent on it because of the effects are quite bad.
Music festivals like Woodstock were also closely linked with the popularity of LSD and acid.
Yeah, and we completely forgot about the great Jimi Hendrix.
Of course, who was also very closely linked.
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix and again Jim Morrison from The Doors, they owe a lot of their music to LSD.
As mentioned, of course, The Beatles.
The Beatles, yes.
And we're going to move on now. Here we go with another song.
Shoot the score! Yeah, so we move on from the 60s and 70s to the 80s when speed was popular. That song was by a band, a digital hardcore band called Atari Teenage Riot, with a track called Speed, of course.
And, you know, Ali, you were talking earlier about the change in recording technology. And when the digital age came to the forefront, the drugs also changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. From the 80s to the 90s, clubs were packed with music that's fast and driving.
Yeah, and so, you know, producers like Orbital and the Chemical Brothers come to mind. And the drug that was heavily linked with this type of music was amphetamines,
methamphetamines. Sorry. No problem. So amphetamines and methamphetamines. And we've got a clip here about just that.
The effect is very similar to cocaine, but more dangerous. That's why it is called poor man cocaine. It is a synthetic drug. It affects on your blood vessels, it affects on your heart, and damage to the brain is much more significant compared to the other drugs. Of all the drugs, prolonged use of methamphetamine or shabu, this is the drug that causes most damage. No other drug will thin out your blood vessels. So when you thin out your blood vessels, chances of stroke, chances of hemorrhage inside the body are very high. It causes your heart to beat irregularly. It causes damage to the brain, especially to the our prefrontal, the way that we think, that it will make a person to become very aggressive. Then they develop psychosis. Appetite will decrease. Within just a couple of years taking methamphetamine, you find they are just like a walking skeleton.
And as you mentioned, just as the music became, you know, faster and more driving, the drugs also became, in many ways, cheaper, harder, more widely available. And some would argue that that has a lot to do with the growth of a certain type of club culture.
Yeah, let me say this again, methamphetamines.
Yeah, there we go.
Yes. You know, that type of drug, it's not specific to just club music or DJ music, because bands were using it too, I guess. Bands like Motorhead and the Primal Scream, and punks in the 80s like the Ramones also had songs linked to the use of these drugs.
Why do you think that is? You know, is there a relationship between the effects that Dr. Mahmoud, you know, just described, or was it also just, you know, just linked to the culture that was going on at the time?
I am tempted to say that, I mean, coming off of what Dr. just told us, thinning of the blood vessels makes you become a bit more edgy. So music at that time was starting to be faster and harder, and they probably needed a drug to supplement that feeling as well. Or I don't know which comes first.
It's a chicken or egg.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so...
But that's, yeah, so that's amphetamines and methamphetamines. Moving on to something else.
That was Darud with Sandstorm, a song that was really popular in the early 2000s.
Yeah, we're going through the ages, so we've breezed past the 80s and 90s, and now we've hit the aughties. And that I guess, is a genre called, and it's one that I'm very unfamiliar with, house music?
House music, rave, yeah.
And house music and MDMA, otherwise known as ecstasy, were pretty much synonymous. I think to this day, that's a relationship that's very closely tied. And like most of the drugs that came from labs rather than leaves, MDMA was first a Cold War thing in the early 1950s, 5 centuries after German chemists patented and then briskly forgot about MDMA. The United States military began researching psychotropic MDMA, LSD and other drugs as means of puppeteering suspected enemies' minds.
Yeah, and the real godfather of MDMA is a man named Alexander Shulgin, a quirky psychopharmacologist from Harvard who began synthesizing and self-testing MDMA in his own backyard in California. He, of course, thought it was a great drug because he created it himself. Interestingly, Dr. Douglas Rushkoff wrote in his book E the incredibly strange history of ecstasy. He says the link between the music and the drug is that the music, the lighting and ambience were all fine-tuned to elicit and augment altered states of consciousness. As you could hear in that beat-driven music by Darude earlier, right? And the rhythm of the music was precisely 120 beats per minute, the frequency of the fetal heart rate, and the same beat believed to be used by South American shamans to bring their tribes into a trance state. Trance is another term for that music. Yep, yep.
And rave dancers sought to reach group consciousness on a level that they had never experienced before, which is something I think you see played out in rave events today as well. And here's what Dr. Mahmood had to say about this particular drug.
Ecstasy is MDMA, even though it's certain countries classify it to be under the methamphetamine group, its effects are different from methamphetamine. It causes slight euphoria, it causes a person to be active. If they don't move their body, they don't have the pleasurable effect. It's not highly dependent, it's not highly addictive, because the longer you take ecstasy, the more unwanted effect that you will have compared to pleasurable effect. They have grinding of the teeth, Parkinsonism, their body starts to shake. Usually after 2 years of taking ecstasy, they will stop because at that time they have more unwanted effects.
Dr. Mahmood and, of course, Dr. Douglas Rushkoff, who you just quoted earlier, I think they're in complete agreement on this. Mm-hmm. And the idea here, I guess, is that ecstasy, unlike the other drugs, it's really closely linked to this form of music because it makes you feel good when you move your body, and which is exactly what this music is designed to make you do. By the late 80s, the term rave, which comes from the French raver, to show signs of madness or delirium, had come to apply to the Nocturnal Congress of Ecstasy-Fueled Souls, a subculture as tactile as the hippies had been.
Yeah, in the 70s, right?
Yep.
And I've got a nice little comment from Henry Rollins, the one-time frontman of punk band Black Flag. He said something really interesting about the abuse of ecstasy. He said, "I don't know which came first, the bad drugs that created the bad music, or because the music was so bad, they had to create a bad drug to enjoy it with."
Henry Rollins, always good for, you know, a little soundbite. Mm-hmm. And now, finally, we're moving on to something that I think kind of transcends in many ways the decades that we've been talking about, because it goes all the way through. But we're kicking things off with a classic. That was Charlie Parker, Groovin' High. And just as we started the show off with marijuana and reggae, but what we really meant to talk about was jazz as well. Mm-hmm. We're ending the show with jazz, but what we really want to talk about is all kinds of other music.
Yeah, and that, at least Charlie Parker, is closely linked to the abuse of heroin or smack. In 1946, the legendary jazz saxophonist Charlie Parker, he was so influential, and he thought he could try and dissuade younger musicians from copying his heroin habit, but succeeded only in fostering a generation of imitators who thought that living the way Charlie Parker did would help them play like him.
And the reason why they wanted to play like him, he was known as the Bird because he could imitate the sound of a bird on the saxophone, and he's highly regarded or highly thought of to have given birth to bebop jazz.
Yep, yep. And see, jazz and heroin was in tandem by the 50s. Even Miles Davis noted in his autobiography, people were considered hip if they did heroin.
And here's what Dr. Mahmood Mazlan had to say about this particular drug.
Heroin is highly addictive. It's the most addictive drug of all the drugs ever that we know. It's the most euphoric drug. You cannot find any other drug that can cause euphoria or the pleasurable compared to heroin. But that's it. It just causes pleasurable. It doesn't make a person to be active. It doesn't make a person to be agitated or become paranoid. The problem with heroin is that is the root of administration. Those who cannot afford heroin, they will ingest it. They ingest it, then you have infectious diseases, especially HIV, and in Malaysia it's hepatitis C. About 90% of all Malaysian heroin drug users had hepatitis C, compared to 1 in 8 of them will have HIV.
Yeah, interesting one there. It is really the most addictive of all drugs out there. And we were in the 50s, and by the 70s, heroin abuse became synonymous with rock music. Sid Vicious from Sex Pistols died of heroin overdose in 79. And in the 90s, Kurt Cobain was also associated with heroin abuse. Stone Temple Pilots frontman Scott Weiland have also been in rehab for heroin abuse.
And in a band that's lasted quite a long time, the Red Hot Chili Peppers were a band that's always been linked to heroin. In fact, they lost two guitarists in a row to the drug. Their early guitarist Hilla Slovak died from an overdose, and John Frusciante has been in and out of rehab trying to get off heroin.
Yep. Actually, Anthony Kiedis, the frontman, is also used to be an addict or user at one time. And he sang this line in their song, Aeroplane. I like pleasure spiked with pain, and music is my aeroplane, from the album One Hot Minute in 1995. So that was like an endorsement of sorts.
It's interesting because if you look at all the songs that we've been talking about, and for that matter, the songs that we didn't even manage to get to, because when you look at the catalogue of drug-related music, it really is wide and vast and has been going on for a very, very long time. And I do think that, if you'll pardon the pun, they do tend to change their tune. I think what musicians write in the heat of their addiction tends to be quite different from what they say once they're out of rehab.
Yeah, of course. And there are a lot of, arguments and debates out there about whether or not drugs can enhance your songwriting, your creative process and all of that.
You could land on the side of Eric Clapton, who said that he never ever wants to listen to the stuff he wrote when he was high. Or you could land on the side of an Eric Clapton fan who says he didn't do anything really great when he was sober. So, it really does depend. But nonetheless, we hope you've enjoyed this musical tour through the history of the links between drugs and music. I have been joined by Dr. Mahmoud Mazlan to a certain extent, and of course by the wonderful Ali Johan, who produces and presents Wavelength here at BFM.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.